I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. I want you to think about the expression claim to fame. Have you noticed nobody ever says claims to fame? For one thing, it doesn't quite rhyme as well, but we just always think about single claims to a place in history, rarely plural claims. It tends to be one thing that upstages everything else in a famous person's life. And in the case of a fellow by the name of Frank Hamer, his claim to fame tends to be as the lawman who finally caught up with the outlaws Bonnie and Clyde. And just like it would be hard to convince people to ever say Clyde and Bonnie, it seems similarly difficult to lead people to a better understanding of the man Frank Hamer. Of all his accomplishments, that notorious situation was hardly the end-all and be-all of his career. In fact, we have a guest with us now who sees Frank Hamer as the greatest American lawman of the 20th century. And if anybody has ever wanted in any way to tarnish the reputation and legacy of lawman Frank Hamer, by sharp contrast, John Bosnecker wants to set the record straight. Bosnecker is a San Francisco trial lawyer, a former police officer, and he's considered to be one of the leading authorities on crime and law enforcement in the Old West. Over decades, he has published dozens of magazine articles about violence on the frontier. He's the award-winning author of 9 books and has frequently appeared on PBS, the History Channel, A&E, and other media as a historical commentator. He's author of Texas Ranger, The Epic Life of Frank Hamer, the Man Who Killed Bonnie and Clyde. John, pleasure to have you with us.
I'm happy to be here, and thanks for having me.
I want to begin with the fact, and I find this very interesting, that one of the outlaws that Frank Hamer sends to the grave had once been employed by Buffalo Bill in those shows of Buffalo Bill. And so are we talking here in this Frank Hamer story about the young West, the middle-aged West, the old West? Where do we situate Frank Hamer?
I consider him to be sort of the quintessential transitional lawman whose career began in the horseback era. So he was an Old West lawman on the Texas-Mexico border shortly after the turn of the century, and then transitioned over into a gang-busting lawman of the 1930s.
So that means he had to go through the same kind of transition the whole country did, going from kind of a rural country to a more urban country.
Yes, in Texas... At that time, and even today, had large rural areas, and the Texas border in particular was pretty much of a frontier up through World War I. And so it was more not just the idea of rural versus urban, but it was the situation of Texas, and I write in the book, it got dragged kicking and screaming into the 20th century because Texans, like many in the West, were married to their frontier heritage, and it was a real change to see modern communications, telephones, automobiles, paved roads. The world changed very quickly between 1900 and 1920.
So do you suppose that for this man, Frank Hamer, that he weathered the transition well? Was it easy for him to come out of the past and live in the present?
I'm not sure you could say it was easy for him, but he certainly did it because he transitioned from a border lawman on horseback battling Mexican and Anglo bandit gangs on the Rio Grande to a modern investigator investigating very complicated murder cases using fingerprints, forensic evidence, pioneering some of these techniques in Texas, being able to use the latest technology, radio, telephone, automobiles, to assist him in tracking outlaws and unraveling crime.
Well, I've already made reference to the fact that he gets a reputation connected with Bonnie and Clyde. That's inextricably a connection. And I'm wondering, we may as well just kind of jump to the very end here. And I understand that Hamer's widow sued Warner Brothers at some point over his reputation?
Yeah, that's true. She was so distraught over the 1968 Warren Beatty film Bonnie and Clyde because Denver Pyle, the actor who played Frank Hamer, portrayed him, according to the script, as the villain in the story and had Hamer captured by Bonnie and Clyde. They tie him up, you know, they humiliate him. And eventually Clyde wants to kill him, but they beat him up and let him go. And then as a result, to seek revenge against Bonnie and Clyde, he sets up an ambush and kills them in revenge. And nothing could be farther from the truth. The only time Bonnie and Clyde came within 20 feet of Frank Hamer, they were dead in about 15 seconds. So what the filmmakers did in the movie Bonnie and Clyde was they took a group of incidents that happened to, there were two other deputy sheriffs who were captured, one in South Texas, another one in Eastern New Mexico. And one I think was a police chief, actually. They were captured by Bonnie and Clyde and kept as a hostage for, you know, a day or one or 2 days, and then they were released. So the filmmakers conflated that with Frank Hamer, which would be fine if you're doing a fictional story. The problem was that Hamer, at that time, Hamer was deceased, but his widow, who was very loyal to him, was very much alive in 1968. And she got a very capable attorney in Houston, Joe Jamail, who actually only passed away a few years ago. He was the top trial lawyer in Texas for probably 40 years. And Jamail sued the studio and Warren Beatty, not for slander or libel, because everybody knows you cannot libel a dead man. And Frank Hamer at that time, he died in 1955, so he'd been dead for 13 years. But Jamail was a very capable lawyer, so he sued for invasion of privacy, using various elements of Hamer's life without permission from the family, that kind of thing, and sued for various business torts. And they received a sizable settlement for 1968. My understanding is, through the family lore, is that Jamail set Warren Beatty's deposition, and the studio had been fighting it. And as soon as that happened, scheduling for Warren Beatty to come in and be deposed under oath, the studio rolled over and settled at that point because they didn't want the bad publicity.
Yeah. For all of that, is it possible that the legal action there did anything to rehabilitate the reputation of Frank Hamer?
I think it did, because it let people know that, you know, maybe this movie isn't exactly right. The other thing that happened was that Gladys Hamer, the widow, sponsored the publication of a book called I'm Frank Hamer, written by two Texas writers who were both became extremely notorious in their own right, and both of whom were murdered in later years. But she sponsored this book, which I read when I was a kid, and when it came out in 1968, I was in high school. I devoured the book. I couldn't afford to buy it, so I rode my bike to the local library and probably read it four times. And later, when I did research on my book, I found that this book, I'm Frank Hamer, has fictional elements in every paragraph in the book almost. So it's not a reliable book. It was sort of like a puff piece to rehabilitate her husband's reputation, and it would have been a lot better if she had hooked up with an actual historian or biographer who could have done a better job of reconstructing Frank Hamer's incredible life.
So there you are in high school, and you're reading this book. Are you more interested in the outlaws Bonnie and Clyde, or are you already on the trail of trying to find out who Frank Hamer really was?
Well, it's kind of funny, because when the movie came out, I was fascinated with it, and it was in all the newspapers, and I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and the local newspaper in San Francisco had a whole page on the movie and then the actual Bonnie and Clyde, and my dad snorted, and he said they were, you know, tin horn robbers. They were nothing compared to John Dillinger, they robbed filling stations. You know, why would anybody make a movie about Bonnie and Clyde? And my father's reaction was fairly common because they were known as sort of these penny ante thieves. They did in actuality rob some banks, but most of their robberies were of gas stations, Piggly Wiggly stores, which at least at that time were very common in the southern states and the Southwest. And so the idea that Bonnie and Clyde were these incredible legendary figures really became amplified by the movie. And in fact, the name of the couple was always Clyde and Bonnie, Clyde and Bonnie, from 1930
really?
Up until 1967, when the movie suddenly became Bonnie and Clyde. And Bonnie and Clyde has a better ring to it, but I think things were probably pretty sexist back then, too, where you'd put the man's name first. But nonetheless, I mean, the movie Bonnie and Clyde is one of the greatest American movies. It's an absolute classic. It's just an incredible, the drama, the acting, the sets, the script, they're all just beyond the pale. But it's a, you know, like most Hollywood depictions, it generally follows the facts, but it's heavily fictionalized. Nonetheless, it's just an absolute masterpiece.
Well, we're going to get into the life of Frank Hamer, but before we do, if you were to pick a single big episode from the life of this lawman, Frank Hamer, for a movie, would it have been Clyde and Bonnie, Bonnie and Clyde?
No, absolutely not, because as I point out in the book, that was one of the least significant things of his career.
Yeah, you might have gone for Red Lopez or something like that.
In my opinion, his fight, and I point this out at great length in the book, I think that in my opinion, the most important thing he did was leading the fight against lynching in Texas in the 1920s. And he led the fight against the Ku Klux Klan. And the absolute pinnacle of that battle was the Sherman Riot in 1930, when Hamer and three Rangers held off a mob of 6,000 who were attempting to lynch a black rape suspect in North Texas. It's one of the two or three greatest events in the history of the Texas Ranger Force. And the Texas Ranger Force has a history that's just beyond the pale when it comes to heroic acts.
Well, I want you to lead us more into the life of this man, Frank Hamer, from his early years. We're going to do that after a short break here on the show. We're visiting with John Bosenecker, and he is author of Texas Ranger, The Epic Life of Frank Hamer, the man who killed Bonnie and Clyde. Stay tuned. Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. It's a pleasure to have John Bosenecker with us. He's author of Texas Ranger, The Epic Life of Frank Hamer, the man who killed Bonnie and Clyde. John Bosenecker, let's start with the early years. I want to know why this young boy eventually became a man, a lawman, with considerable skill. Was he suited for this? Was he a natural? How did he start out?
Molded by his boyhood years in the Texas Hill Country. He was born in the early 1880s in Texas in a rural area, grew up in what today we would consider to be abject poverty, you know, in a board frame house. His father was a blacksmith. You know, there was no running water, no electricity, no paved roads. He loved the outdoors. He was something that I was unaware of until I began doing my research, that he was incredibly intelligent. He had an IQ. I mean, if they gave IQ tests back then, it would be very much on the high IQ level. Turns out in later years, this became evident that he had a photographic memory for names, for faces. These are all things that combined to make him, in my opinion, the greatest lawman of the 20th century. He became an outdoorsman as a young man, young boy, really. At one point, he said he spent 2 or 3 years sleeping outdoors without any interruption. He became an expert hunter. a tracker, able to read sign. He loved the American Indian. He tried to model himself after the American Indian to live a life of honor and sacrifice. He also, and one thing that was very unusual, because white supremacy, it's all, you know, tossed around today. You know, Lincoln was a white supremacist. General Grant was a white supremacist. I mean, the terms racism and white supremacy in the last year are losing their effect, because white supremacy was, in fact, a way of life in the South and in Texas in the 19th century and in the earlier through the mid-20th century. And Frank Hamer grew up in this culture of what was white supremacy, actual white supremacy. And but when he was a teenager, about 17 or 19 years old, he was involved in a dispute with a disreputable neighbor. And when I say neighbor, it was a guy who lived a few miles away from their farm in San Saba County in the Texas Hill Country. And the neighbor shot Hamer and put about 18 birdshot or turkey shot into his body, almost killed him. And a black field hand saved Hamer's life, rushed him to a doctor. So Frank Hamer spent the rest of his life trying to pay this back to the African-American community. And you can see that in the Texas Ranger reports. And this is something that I was totally unaware of when I began doing my research on Frank Hamer about 10 years ago. I went, made many trips to Texas, reviewed the original Texas Ranger reports, reviewed old newspapers and court records and that kind of thing. And it became evident, and especially when you read the Ranger reports and the efforts by the Rangers to protect blacks from lynch mobs, that was something that was ingrained in him, not only by his experience as a Texas Ranger, but by this debt that he felt he owed to this black field hand who had saved his life.
Doesn't he also have to kind of get out of town and stay out of this assailant's way? And he moves to West Texas.
Correct. And so his parents send him to West Texas, where he works as a cowboy. And this is in 1905. At that point, they have these newfangled telephones. And Hamer is bored on this remote ranch, so he would get on the party line back then for the younger listeners who've never heard of a party line. When I was a kid, we used to have them, where a group of neighbors, 6 or 10 or 12, all share the same phone line. So you pick up the phone, and if somebody's talking, you hang up immediately. You never listen in, at least where I grew up, it was a big no-no to listen in on a phone line. And then you wait till they're finished, and then you pick up the line and make your call. And so you don't have long conversations on a phone line. But apparently back in West Texas region where Hamer was, there was really not much else to do. So he'd get on the party line and listen to all the farmers and ranchers gossip about the weather and that kind of thing and the crops and everything. And all of a sudden, call comes through that there's a horse thief escaping and on the way toward the ranch where Hamer is working. And he immediately interrupts the sheriff and says, "I'll go catch him if you want me to." And the sheriff says, "Please help me." So Hamer at this point is about 21 years old. He's a dead shot, an expert horseman, an expert outdoorsman, an expert tracker. So he captures this horse thief and holds him for the sheriff. And the sheriff is so impressed. And soon after, Hamer assists the sheriff again in another capture. And so by this time, the sheriff decides this young man, who's now 22 years old, should be recommended as a Texas Ranger. And he does that. And Hamer is hired as a Texas Ranger. And his captain, Captain John Rogers, who's known as one of the four great captains of the Texas Ranger period after the Civil War, Rogers was a very religious man deeply concerned about both racism against Latinos and blacks, spent a lot of his career protecting blacks and Latinos from lynch mobs and from other kinds of violence. Hamer idolized Captain Rogers. Rogers was known as the praying captain. He carried a Winchester rifle and a Bible. So Hamer learned from him, and he'd already had this background, I owe this to this black field hand, and then he learns the same thing from Captain Rogers. And so he became sort of a mentor. Captain Rogers became a mentor of Frank Hamer, and that had a huge impact on his later career as a Texas Ranger and lawman.
Well, now we've gotten him to the point where he is a Texas Ranger, but I understand his employment there was a little bit on again, off again?
Yeah, that was very typical back then. Under the, you know, the mythical idea, some guy becomes a Texas Ranger and then stays for 30 years. That's how things work today because we have, you know, we don't have the spoil system in politics anymore. We have civil service protections. So you have law enforcement officers everywhere in the country who get hired and keep their jobs for their whole career, which is the only stable way to have a stable government, whether it's the health department, the finance department, the tax collector's office, whatever it is. You need to have experienced and honest people running our government. But that's not the way it was back then. You had the spoil system. Every time a new governor would come in, he'd fire all the current rangers and hire all his political appointees. And the other problem was the ranger force paid terribly low, $40 a month for risking your life, where a police officer in Houston or Dallas in 1908, 1910 earned about $100 a month. So the ranger pay was not increased till 1919, and it was the same through much of the late 19th century up through 1919. It was $40 a month. And they lived outdoors, lived in army tents, and provided their own horses and equipment. So you had to be really, really dedicated. So many of these rangers obtained experience, and then they'd be hired, offered a job, which is what happened to Hamer. He got sent to East Texas due to racial troubles, again, to protect blacks and Latinos from mob violence, which was something that the ranger spent a lot of time doing. There's a new book about the Texas Rangers called Cult of Glory, which tells the opposite story. It claims that the Rangers were all racist and were all horrible, and obviously that's, you know, not accurate. It, you know, kind of surprising that someone would write a book as biased as that, because history is gray. It's not black. It's not white. It's a proper history is balanced. And in Frank Hamer's case, the other side of the Texas Rangers, not the Texas Rangers who are out battling the Comanche, not the Texas Rangers who are killing Mexicans and Mexican-Americans on the border. This is a Texas Ranger force that is going into East Texas and protecting Latino workers, protecting blacks from mob violence. So there's definitely two sides to the story. Not to say that Texas Rangers were all saints. They clearly weren't. But in Hamer's case, he participated in these types of protections in East Texas. So he is actually assigned to work in Grimes County, where Navasota, which is a very rowdy cotton town, was located. And then the local folks liked him, and he ended up getting hired as the city marshal of Navasota and had a lot of adventures as the marshal of Navasota, got into one or two gunfights, captured a lot of outlaws and desperados.
Well, I want you to tell us a little bit more detail about this mob of 6,000, the lynch mob, and what Frank Hamer's role, you say, with three other law enforcement officials. They dispersed the crowd? What do they do?
Yeah, and that was later in his life. This is 1930. So by this time, Frank Hamer is a senior captain of the Texas Rangers. He's the most famous lawman in the Southwest because at that point, he has, you know, 25 years of experience, been in the newspapers over and over again. He's by far the most famous lawman in Texas. And so what happens is a black man is accused of raping a white wife of a farmer near Sherman in North Texas. And he's placed in the county jail. A massive mob surrounds the courthouse. They demand that this prisoner be released. Hamer tells them nothing doing. He's been called up with three of his men to help guard. There's a handful of deputy sheriffs that are there. So the mob eventually starts to come up the steps of the courthouse, and Hamer tells them, if you come any farther, there's going to be a lot of funerals in Sherman tonight. And at this point, he's a very experienced. He's been in more than 50 gun battles on the border. He's killed 23 or 24 outlaws in the line of duty, one of the most dangerous gunfighters in American history. And the mob pays no attention to him, so he opens fire with a pump shotgun and shoots the two mob leaders in the legs. They tumble down the stairs, and the mob flees in terror. And so then high school students, and this tells you about racism, it's just so pervasive in Texas in that era, high school students get gallon cans of gasoline, light them on fire, and throw them through the downstairs windows of the courthouse, set the whole courthouse ablaze. Everybody flees except for Hamer and the Rangers. The county judge had ordered that the black defendant, who, by the way, was certainly guilty, the evidence against him was overwhelming, but in any event, the black prisoner, the judge orders that he be locked into the clerk's vault to protect him from the mob. But what happens is everybody flees at the flames, and Hamer and his men rush through the courthouse for an extended period of time trying to find frantically the key to the vault. But the people with the key have fled, and finally, when the courthouse is engulfed in flames, Hamer and his men finally come out, and the prisoner dies in the vault. He's asphyxiated. And so Hamer was able to, you know, fend off, drive off the mob, but he never in a million years anticipated or dreamed that the community would burn down its own courthouse in just this mindless racial assault on justice.
Well, this raises the question of what kept him going at a moment like this. This would be a moment for incredible disillusionment with society, with the system, with justice.
Yes, and his widow later said that he was absolutely disgusted, that it was one of the worst episodes of his life. Until his dying day, he was disgusted with the acts of the people of Sherman, because he had seen, at this point, Hamer had already saved 15 African Americans from lynch mobs between 1906 or 07 and World War II, over and over and over again. He had gone with other Rangers to different towns in East Texas, and they would get these black prisoners, they would bundle them into a horseback, into a buggy, into a railroad train, and just get them out of town. Or they would, in many cases, they would stand off the lynch mobs if they had enough Rangers to do it. But sometimes there's only two Rangers in a mob of hundreds. So in those cases, they would hide the prisoner. In one of the most famous incidents, which happened near Houston, Hamer and another police detective take the black prisoner, sneak him out of the county jail. There's a mob of like several thousand trying to lynch the prisoner. They head out into the swamps, and they spent the whole night crawling on their bellies in the mud, hiding the actually two prisoners in that case, hiding them from the mob. And Hamer later said that you could see the lanterns of the mob and the Klan members, you know, just like 30, 40 feet away from where they were hidden. And you can't imagine the terror of these two black suspects or defendants, prisoners, thinking that, you know, one noise and they'd be strung up by a mob. And so Hamer, in that case, was able to avoid the mob just at daylight. They managed to make it out onto the railroad tracks. They flagged down a freight train, and brought the prisoners into a nearby town where they were able to lock them up safely in jail. So he had many incidents like that.
Yeah.
And these are incidents which, interestingly enough, are not depicted in the 1968 book I'm Frank Hamer, because the authors of that book were just as racist as anybody else in the 1930s, and either, I can't imagine, they didn't know about it. I mean, Hamer, this is something that he was most proud of in his life, and they just decided, oh, well, we don't like this idea of him protecting black people, so we're leaving it out of our book. I mean, it was good for me because I got to tell the story for the first time in my book, but very, very dishonest for any historian to not show both sides of the coin.
Well, I would like to visit with you a little bit about this fellow by the name of Red Lopez. I know that this is not a significant story by comparison to Hamer's defending of people from lynch mobs. But this is not insignificant, because with Rafael or Red Lopez, we're talking about probably the biggest shootout in the history of Utah. And here I sit not but 20 miles or less from where Red Lopez had the first shootout with Utah lawmen. I understand 5 Utah lawmen killed. And then eventually this outlaw makes his way back to Texas, and that's where Hamer comes in. What's important to you about the Red Lopez story?
Well, the Lopez story is significant because it shows Hamer's ability as a manhunter, because Lopez was involved in a number of shootings in the mining region near Salt Lake. As you mentioned, he killed 5 lawmen. He fled into a mine, and the mine was blocked off. The entrances were boarded up. Fires were set to try to smoke him out. He had actually killed an officer inside the mine, one of the number of officers that he killed in gunfights who were trying to capture him. And finally, he escaped the mine. And there's been some dispute over whether he really escaped the mine or not, but it's, you know, the evidence is uncontroverted that his rifle was found outside the mine near a railroad track, and that he apparently escaped. It's not exactly clear how he got out of Utah, but the evidence is that he was able to get into a mining car, like a small gauge railroad track, and was able to escape on a small train, and then probably got onto a regular freight train out of Utah. He had returned to his hometown in Mexico. Then he became a leader of a large bandit gang. And while Frank Hamer was a Texas Ranger captain in 1921, so this would be about 10 years after these killings in Utah, Hamer got a tip that Lopez and his gang would be approaching this certain spot not too far from Laredo. The evidence seems to be that Hamer and his men actually crossed over onto the Mexican side of the border, which they would do occasionally to pursue outlaws. It was a violation of the neutrality laws and everything, but it was nonetheless something that they did. And they set up an ambush, and Hamer had actually been badly wounded in another gunfight in 1917. So he was still suffering from a bullet wound in his shoulder, and he later described, while he was waiting for the Lopez gang to come forward across this desert country, he was in an irrigation ditch, and he would lean against the wooden gate on the irrigation ditch to kind of relieve the pain that he felt in his shoulder. And so finally, this gang came into sight. They ordered them to surrender. This huge gunfight broke out, and Hamer and his company of about, I can't remember the exact number, but 8 or 10 Rangers killed Rafael Lopez and 5 or 6 or 7 of his gang, and achieved retribution and or justice for the murders of the Utah lawmen 10 years earlier.
There are so many stories here. We're going to have to talk about LBJ in a little bit, but we're not even there yet. And that's just a remarkable story. But I'm wondering if it would be possible for you to talk a little bit about Prohibition and his stance there, his work in law enforcement. That he didn't drink himself much, I understand.
did in later life, because there's a story of him drinking heavily because his older son was killed in action at Iwo Jima in World War II. His older son was in the United States Marine Corps, and Hamer did drink heavily after that because he was so distraught over his son's death. But yes, prior to that, he drank rarely anything. There's a pretty well-known story of a celebration in a hotel room, and Hamer took his bottle of champagne, glass of champagne, and poured it down the sink because he didn't drink. But yes, he would leave the Ranger Force, come back, leave, come back. This was most of them did that, seeking higher pay. So in Prohibition, the Prohibition agents came into being, and their job was to fight, liquor sales. And he became a Prohibition agent shortly after the enactment of Prohibition in 1919. And as a Prohibition agent, he was sent down to El Paso because there were numerous fatal shootings of both federal and local law enforcement officers by Mexican tequileros, or tequila smugglers. And Hamer came down and was assigned to assist in safely combating these smugglers. And one of the incidents that happened that you can, there's two ways to look at it, but many of the tequila smugglers were former members of Pancho Villa's gang. And this was in 1920. The Mexican Revolution was over, and these guys were rendered unemployed. So many of them took to smuggling tequila across the border because it was legal in Mexico, illegal in the U.S. And Hamer shows up, and he says to these Prohibition agents, or Prohis, as they were called, "What are you fellows doing to get so many people killed down here?" And they told him, "Well, we see the smugglers trying to cross the line. We order them to surrender. They start shooting, and one of us always ends up dead or wounded." And he says, Hamer tells them, "That's not how it's done." So they go down to the border. They get a tip in what was called the Island, which is this area about a half mile southwest of downtown El Paso. And it was sort of a no man's land where the river, the Rio Grande, had changed course. So there was an area that at one point was in either Mexico or the U.S., and then the river changed, and then there was a dispute over who actually owned this area. And the smugglers had built trenches, they'd built huts, all this whole operation for smuggling tequila. So Hamer, with a number of other federal and state lawmen, about six of them, go down and set up an ambush. And that night, they see this band of tequila smugglers coming, and I can't remember how many. There's three or four or five of them, and they're all heavily armed. And suddenly, Hamer and another federal agent, who also is a former Texas Ranger, they're armed with semi-automatic weapons. They jump to their feet and just opened a barrage of semi-automatic fire and killed these four, five, or six smugglers in their tracks. And Hamer then went up and poked them with his boot and says, "Now yell Manos Arribas at these SOBs." And as I point out in the book, if you view that as a civil police act or a police action, then it would be murder because they didn't order these guys to surrender. However, if you view it as a military act where you have a quasi or paramilitary situation, then it was justifiable because in warfare, you never tell the opponent to put their weapon down. If you see an armed combatant, you shoot as quickly as you can before they shoot you. So that one, I basically leave my readers up to determine which one they think that situation falls under.
Well, you did say earlier that history is gray, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, let's get to LBJ in just a moment. I need to take a short break here on the show, but boy, what a fascinating connection this is going to be. I can hardly wait to hear you talk about it. We're visiting with John Bosnecker, and he is author of Texas Ranger, The Epic Life of Frank Hamer, the Man Who Killed Bonnie and Clyde. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Smith. This is Constant Wonder. John Bosnecker is with us, and he knows about the West, the history of the West in the United States. He's author of Texas Ranger, The Epic Life of Frank Hamer, the man who killed Bonnie and Clyde. LBJ, should he have become a senator, or was there a rigged election, or are we back to a gray area of history here?
Well, you know, the election, in my opinion, one of the most important Senate elections of the 20th century was the 1948 election and campaign for United States Senator of Texas. And because, to briefly anticipate the story, LBJ was elected. That directly led his path to the White House, as Robert Caro, his great biographer, calls it, the path to power. And then, you know, led to the enactment of the Great Society, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, things that were so critical for the African-American community, to sort of a groundswell change in American culture. And that was all made possible by what happened in 1948 when LBJ was elected U.S. Senator. Of course, the people that don't like LBJ talk about how he got us into the Vietnam War, at least got us more embedded into the Vietnam War. But again, like we've said over and over again, history is gray. There were wonderful things about LBJ and obviously things about LBJ that are not particularly admirable. But in any event, Robert Caro got widely criticized for pointing out how LBJ was elected by ballot fraud in South Texas in 1948. And the fact is that Caro, in his, he wrote a three-volume history of LBJ, you know, among the most important political biographies of the last several generations, in my opinion. But Mr. Caro was absolutely correct. You know, what happened was the LBJ was losing the Senate election. And it was, when I say the election, it was the primary, because at that time, Texas was entirely Democratic, and whoever won the Democratic primary would always win either the governorship or the U.S. Senate seat or whatever they were running for. So Caro describes this accurately, that the election is being lost by LBJ, and he's short some hundreds of votes. And at that point, South Texas was run by political bosses, and they had these patrons who were the sort of father figures who would provide jobs and protection for Latinos, and in return, they insisted on and got block voting. But that wasn't enough. So in this particular area of South Texas, LBJ's people make a panic call. You know, we need X number of votes, 200 or 300, whatever the number was. So the political boss down there simply has his cronies stuff the ballot box with fake votes. And word comes out, and Hamer at this point is a retired Texas Ranger, but again, he's this famous character in Texas, and he's asked to go down with two former FBI agents to investigate. And they go down to the polling place. There's a bunch of armed, what the witnesses call pistoleros or gunfighters, you know, gunmen, guarding the polling place, and they try to block Hamer, and suddenly people start gasping, "It's Captain Hamer, it's Captain Hamer," and these guys get out of the way instantly. And so the two former FBI agents, who are both lawyers, go in, start examining, and sure enough, the ballot list, all the names are signed in the same hand. They're all fake signatures. And they gather all this evidence. And then finally, the ballot, the people in charge of the poll insist that they leave, and they finally leave. And so what happens is the information is used in a lawsuit to set aside the election results, and there's sort of this fishy hearing held before one member of the United States Supreme Court, who then dismisses the lawsuit. And then by that point, it's moot because the election's all over with, and LBJ is elected. So LBJ, and I think most historians now accept the fact that he was elected as a result of ballot fraud in South Texas. You know, the people that attacked Robert Caro when his first book came out and he pointed out the fraud, that was closer. I can't remember the book, the year his book came out, but at that point it was fresher in people's minds, and people that loved LBJ just couldn't imagine that he could be involved in or benefit from ballot fraud. But today there's absolutely no doubt about it.
Well, I guess that we have to tie a bow on this now because we're out of time, but it sounds like Frank Hamer had a career that extended over a lot of decades and certainly had a lot more interest than just that Bonnie and Clyde story.
Exactly, and that's why I say that Bonnie and Clyde, well, it's the most sensational thing he did and the most famous thing he did, killing Bonnie and Clyde. Definitely one of the least significant when you compare with these other incidents we've been talking about.
And just in 20 seconds or so, is it true that if Frank Hamer had had his way, he might have taken Bonnie and Clyde prisoner rather than shooting them?
He later said, "I hate to bust a cap on a woman." And because all these gunfights, 52 gunfights, he'd never fired on a woman. It was incomprehensible to harm a woman. He was a family man. He had two stepdaughters. And just this idea that you harm a woman to him was incomprehensible.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
They'd already murdered 12 law enforcement officers. So he insisted that they order them to surrender. There was a big dispute over that. It turned out to be irrelevant because the most inexperienced man is in his posse panicked and started shooting. And that resulted in what they call today in law enforcement, they call it sympathetic fire, where other officers hear the gunfire and it causes them to start shooting
right.
as well.
Right.
But at that point, it was a foregone conclusion because Bonnie and Clyde were killed instantly in this barrage of gunfire.
John Bosenecker, a pleasure to have a chance to visit with you. Thanks for your time and for the explanations.
And thanks again for having me.
John Bosenecker, a San Francisco trial lawyer, a former police officer, an expert on the Old West, and we've been talking about his book, Texas Ranger, The Epic Life of Frank Hamer, the Man Who Killed Bonnie and Clyde. I've got something quite enjoyable for you now, very short to round out this hour. It's a quick look at another legendary detective from American history, not a lawman per se like Frank Hamer, but this fellow did a lot of contract work for the U.S. government before and during the Civil War, and his private detective agency became the most famous private security and investigative company in the world. His name, Alan Pinkerton. And Pinkerton's rise to national fame got a really big boost in February 1861 when he helped to detect and foil a plot to kill President-elect Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln was about to travel through Baltimore. To learn more, I had a chance to speak with Josh Mensch, who is co-author of The Lincoln Conspiracy, The Secret Plot to Kill America's 16th President and Why It Failed. Here's that highlight from the conversation I told you about. This is the moment in our conversation when Pinkerton comes to Lincoln's hotel room in Philadelphia to warn him, and an explanation of why Lincoln could not leave right then, as Pinkerton was urging.
Abraham Lincoln first learned of the plot to assassinate him just after midnight in Philadelphia in his hotel room. He had just had probably an 18-hour day traveling and giving speeches and attending events. And he's in a city where there are just throngs of people surrounding the hotels and on the streets because his arrival was, you know, a momentous occasion. And so it was a very chaotic moment, and he's just absolutely exhausted. And as he's about to finally go to bed in his hotel room, there's a knock on the door from one of his close associates saying, "Abraham Lincoln, you absolutely must meet with someone right now. And that someone is Alan Pinkerton, the detective, who at that hour informs him that there is a plot to assassinate him in Baltimore in about 36 hours on his way to Washington, D.C. Pinkerton's first idea is to have Lincoln get on a train literally that moment. They were just going to leave the hotel and get on a train. But Lincoln says, I cannot do that. And here's why I cannot do that, because in the morning here in Philadelphia, I am about to attend an incredibly important event. And it was a flag raising at Independence Hall, the site of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, to commemorate George Washington's birthday. And George Washington had been a personal hero of Abraham Lincoln's. But even beyond that, at a moment when the country is in crisis, the country is splitting apart, six states have already seceded, Lincoln knows that he absolutely must attend this event, because for him to skip out on it with a big crowd expecting him to raise this flag at Independence Hall, at the site of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, at a moment when the nation is in crisis, he just had to be there. So he shows up and he gives an absolutely wonderful speech to the assembled crowd before he is to raise this flag. And at the end of the speech, he kind of loses himself for a moment, and he's talking about the values of liberty enshrined in the Declaration of Independence. And he sort of has this moment where he stops talking and he pauses and he suddenly says, I would rather be assassinated right here on the spot than surrender those values. And no one in the crowd has any idea that only about 6 hours earlier, Lincoln had just heard that there was a plot to assassinate him. And so clearly it was on his mind, and he almost lets it slip. This idea that he could be assassinated is a real one. And the speech kind of went unnoticed because no one else knew, except for him, what he was referring to.
Josh Manch is co-author of The Lincoln Conspiracy, The Secret Plot to Kill America's 16th President and Why It Failed. Speaking of assassination attempts, over the course of history, many a king, a royal, a monarch has been assassinated or maybe just banished or deposed. People want to get the ruler out of the way. Have you ever considered what it would actually take to depose a queen bee? I'm speaking now about the insect, actually, not metaphorically, an actual queen bee, one who rules over the hive with either tyranny or maybe just her innate charm. I don't know how they rule. A little spoiler for you, the queen bee does not actually rule over the hive. Mostly she just lays a lot of eggs. And apparently she's a good sport when it's time for her to go or to abdicate. We're going to talk with an urban beekeeper and a bee rescuer to gain a better appreciation of the politics, the dynamics, maybe we should just say, of a wild honeybee hive. That's tomorrow here on Constant Wonder. Our show is a production of BYU Radio.